Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Minute 68, and it looks like the party's over at Hydra headquarters. So everybody's heading for the doors or the respective rocket packs or whatever. Hal, get us up to speed on minute 68 here.
All right. Minute 68, not a scratch, Doctor. Steve Rogers, supporting Bucky Barnes, scrambles up a catwalk stairway in the crumbling Hydra factory, explosions rocking the structure. Come on, let's go up. Steve urges, his voice steady. In a rising elevator, Dr. Arnim Zola glances nervously at the red skull.
Sir?
Are we going to the roof? The doors slide open, revealing a sleek one-passenger rotary-winged rocket.
What about me? Where will I sit? Zola asks, his voice trembling.
The red skull drops a keychain with a Hydra logo-shaped key into Zola's hand.
Not a scratch, Doctor. Not a scratch. He says, striding toward the rocket.
The elevator doors close with Zola inside. Steve and Bucky reach a cracked girder spanning a fiery chasm, a cable hoist dangling precariously. In the basement garage, Zola tosses his valise into the back seat of the Red Skull's sleek car, climbs into the driver's seat, and revs the engine. Twin doors slide open, and he speeds into the night. On the factory roof, the Red Skull's rotocopter whirs to life, its rocket-powered blades spinning. He seals the canopy and lifts off into the dark sky. Back on the girder, Steve steadies Bucky. Let's go, one at a time, he says as explosions rumble below. Bucky steps onto the creaking girder, his movements cautious.
Wow.
It's the good stuff.
A lot going on.
Yeah. It's a very active minute. And that rotocopter does not have... I mean, I don't know much about helicopters and stuff, but if something's spinning one way, shouldn't he be spinning the other way as fast as...
You know, it's... Yes. I mean, should we dive right in?
I think it's time to chat about that.
Because, Hal, I would love your insight, because I was trying to figure out exactly what the aerodynamic surfaces are on this thing. Is it essentially a helicopter? What is it?
It is a... it's what we would call a tail sitter. Now, just as a quick aside, the first person to really publicly think about that as an idea, and that's an aircraft that takes off and lands vertically, akin to a helicopter, and then rather than a tilt rotor or something like an Osprey or something, it rotates horizontally for level flight and then would come back to vertical and land on its tail. So the first patent for that, just as a bit of trivia, nobody ever did anything with it, was Nikola Tesla, 1928. But in this case, so Jim, you're talking about the torque reactions and things. So this design was a very nice rendering of of something that was planned but never built by Focke-Wulf, known as, I've got to be careful with this, the Triebflügel or thrust wing.
Gesundheit.
Yes, thank you. So the idea is that you've got a central fuselage, as we see, and then you can think of it as three small wings or just a giant propeller with the power plants at the tips. Now, because these power plants, which we'll get to in just a second, are at the tips like that, you don't actually have the traditional torque reaction. So you wouldn't be spinning the other way.
Because the motor's not in the fuselage.
Because it's not in the fuselage. It's the thrust is coming from the tips. Now, this idea of a tip jet or tip rocket, was actually built and used successfully in helicopters. So Brian, out in your neck of the woods, you can go see one at the Hiller Museum in San Carlos. Hiller built built several little tip jet helicopters, and that's a good idea on paper because you don't have to have an anti-torque system like a tail rotor or something like that in a helicopter, but it does end up being really complicated. Like the whole idea of having to pump fuel inside the rotor blades out there. So that's how the Hiller tip jet worked. As I understand it, I guess I should double check that about the fuel, but that was certainly what Focke-Wulf had in mind for this Triebflügel.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to just take a second and describe for our viewers or listeners who may not have the movie in front of them. What we're talking about is this vehicle, the Red Skull's escaping in, which is looks like it's basically an elongated football shape, maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 stories tall, with 3 rotors up near the top of it that spin like and they have rockets on the end of it. So that's what you're talking about is
right.
It's basically looks kind of like a helicopter. It also looks like one of those, I forget what they're called, but the toys you play with where you spin the stick in your hands and you let them go when they fly up in the air and come back down.
Looks a little like that. Yeah.
So I just wanted to paint the picture for folks who maybe haven't seen the movie in a while, but
that's go perfect. Ahead. So yeah, you've got that rotor with the power plants that are on the edge on the ends, and that can spin freely around sort of around the tire fuselage, where the fuselage stays motionless. So the original plan for this it would have been built as an interceptor, designed as an interceptor, and one of these sort of desperation meets innovation things late in the war. The Germans were experimenting and coming up with so many different ideas. But the idea is this is something you jump in and you can go straight up without a runway and you can get up to the altitude, find the mass formations of Allied bombers, you know, and shoot them up. And then in theory, come back and land. One of the things about this design, I've mentioned the power plants on the rotor tips. So they were actually intended to be rockets to start the thing spinning. And then once it got going fast enough, those nacelles that you see were intended to be ramjets. And the ramjet is an oddball thing. It's kind of a tough thing to describe. A ramjet is a type of jet engine that can go really fast as long as it's already going really fast.
Right.
It doesn't have the internal compressors or anything that accelerate and compress the air. So for a ramjet to work, you've got to do something else to get it going quickly. And then that high speed air coming in is what causes the compression and the combustion and things. So you get rockets to get it started. And then the ramjets come into play.
It's like a carburetor propulsion almost. You're spraying fuel and air together and it explodes right. out one direction and off you go.
Exactly. So ramjets, you know, are efficient at supersonic speeds and things. So we're not really talking about the speed of the aircraft. We're just talking about how fast the rotors themselves are spinning. So these things spinning in a circle. In the U.S., we built a few different tail sitter designs. The Soviets had one. The French worked on one. We had the XFV and the Pogo, which would look somewhat similar to this, although they use a traditional turboprop engine with counter-rotating props on the nose. And it would take off and then sort of lean over and then fly more vertically like an airplane. So with this, it's unclear exactly how, once it was in level flight, are the rotors still spinning and just providing thrust with no real wing area, or do the engines rotate and the blades go flat and provide some wing area with the ramjets? Presumably, it would make a lot more sense for that rotor to stop spinning. But the biggest problem that we ever had with any of this idea of the tail sitter is landing. And that is you're going really, really fast and you got to pitch up and slow down. Now you've got to land behind you. You know, you're looking straight up out the cockpit of the thing and trying to figure out exactly, okay, where's the ground and where's my spot to land on. Now in a desperation, semi-desperation move like this with an interceptor, you know, the Germans aren't too worried about how the pilot's going to land. They assume he's sort of going to figure it out. The biggest thing is get up there and shoot down the bombers. But that landing issue was really one of the biggest reasons, you know, on top of some inefficiencies and stuff, that we didn't really go farther with the tail sitter idea.
I'm noticing a blue glow on those engines, and I'm just wondering if this could be some of Dr. Zola's Tesseract powered.
Sure, absolutely. Designs. Just like SHIELD is going to use to float their helicarriers in 30 years.
Exactly, a little Tesseract juice.
That's pretty close to a 109 cockpit cover, isn't it, Hal?
It's very similar. Just that heavy armored framework that you saw that's so prevalent in the German designs, that they went for rugged, faceted edges with a lot of framework and then a lot of heavy armored glass in between, versus more of the Allied designs, especially by the time of the Mustang and the later model Spitfires, were bubble canopies and things, more comfortable and prettier. Very quickly, before we get away from this, I think personally the coolest implementation of any kind of tip jet rotor system was on the Fairey Rotodyne. And if those of you have never seen it, you ought to look it up and watch some video of it. It was a commuter airliner that had short stubby wings and traditional turboprop engines, and then a big rotor on top. And they would use these little tip jet rockets to start the rotor spinning, and it could take off vertically. Then it would accelerate. Then the main rotor went unpowered, so the thing became a gigantic passenger carrying autogyro. Then when it was time to land, it would slow down and they could actually reignite the rockets on the tips. And that would turn the rotor from something that was freewheeling in the wind to a powered rotor, and they could land vertically like a helicopter. And this thing was real. It flew, it worked. It was just unbearably loud. So we never got the British dream of, these commuter airliners going from rooftop to rooftop and city to city.
So. Yeah, you talk about this intersection or this technology being an interceptor, and I realize I'm looking at special effects in a more or less fantasy movie, but this thing doesn't look like it's particularly fast or maneuverable. It looks like it'd be pretty easy to shoot down.
I would sure think that it would be. Now the speed would come, or I should say the importance of the timing is in its vertical climb rate. So number one, it would in theory be quick to launch. It doesn't have to roll down a runway. It starts climbing. And presumably once those ramjets kicked in, when that rotor is spinning supersonic, then it's going to be going insanely fast, but it would certainly take a while for it to accelerate and get going. And then, as I said, then it's just straight up into a cloud of bombers, much like the modus operandi of the ME-163 Comet. It's a rocket that's just going to go up and shoot, and then maybe shoot again on the way back down, and then the comet's going to glide and land. This thing would go up through, shoot, and then, get out of there, and then somehow
land like a lawn dart.
Land like a lawn dart. So you imagine just backing into your garage at, 100 miles an hour with no mirrors or backup camera or anything. So.
Wow. Yeah. It's the place of the Electric Lightning, which was my old company, British Aerospace, used to make. And it's only the only design element on it was point at the sky and get up into the sky as fast as you can. So.
And that was the same with the Soviets and the MiG-25.
Right.
That was meant to counter the XB-70. It's just, we need to get a lot of firepower up as quickly as possible. And, we'll sacrifice maneuverability and comfort and, landability.
I confess, I'm astonished that the Red Skull's aircraft here has any resemblance to reality. But you're saying that these things existed more or less in this form?
Well, this one was on the drawing board. It was never built. And certainly we've never seen a tail sitter like this where the rotor sort of spun around the body and was that big. But if you take a look at the XFV and the Pogo, you'll see similarities. They had a more traditional engine up at the nose of the thing. So we didn't see the tip jet, and we didn't see that complicated mechanism of the rotors spinning around the body, but it was something Focke-Wulf was looking at, and it wasn't the single craziest thing they were thinking about at the time. But of course, in our MCU, it stands to reason that Hydra, would have maybe taken it off the drawing board and gotten it working, or maybe Hydra came up with it first.
Where power is not an issue, it's like if you've got the blue glue, the blue glow, you can do anything with it. So
exactly.
I just want to note from a comic book perspective that in a couple of early issues of the Fantastic Four, Reed Richards invented a pogo plane that had vertical takeoff and landing capability.
Oh, wow.
And they actually called it the Fantastic Four's pogo plane. So I'm guessing either Jack Kirby or Stan Lee at some point in the early 60s read some article or saw some piece in Popular Mechanics about pogo planes and decided, hey, we should have one of those.
So. It's a cool idea, and it looks it it looks so intuitive and it still looks sort of futuristic. Like I said, until, you know, on top of some other technical things, but until you really think about how do I land this thing? How do I land going backwards when I can't see anything behind me at all?
That's when you release the balloon up on top. Yes, exactly. Mary Poppins' umbrella comes out. Yeah, it's, I mean, it gave me also the vibe of the. We've been talking about this online lately. The B-42, the Mixmaster, the one with the tail, had this giant tail propeller.
Right.
But it was built like for. I think it was transonic. It was supposed to be like a high speed, rear facing propeller. That was just it's like I could see somebody doodling this on a cafeteria napkin at lunchtime at Lockheed and going, oh, let's make one of these.
Right, let's give this a try. Yeah, and that B-42 is at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force and being restored, if I remember correctly. So they've had that back in storage for quite a while. So that'll be neat to see. Not a tail sitter, but another one of those oddball. As you said, kind of back of the napkin, maybe this would work.
This wouldn't be exactly impossible. Yeah, if you really want to see some wild ideas that have been turned into, titanium, definitely a trip to Dayton to see the U.S. Air Force Museum, because they've got it all when it comes to what the heck were you thinking when you put this together?
Exactly.
Wow. Well,
but that's how we innovate, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you never know. I'm back earlier in this minute where we're looking at car keys, and the set that Red Skull drops into Dr. Zola's hands, it looks like you could gut a fish with that thing. It's like,
yeah, I want that fob.
Yeah. It's, it's a pretty impressive thing. And, you know, you'd think that of all the stuff that Zola would have come up with, he would have come up with a little bit better idea than a two-pronged key. And how many of those cars are around that you really need that? You know, maybe he would just have like a keyless entry or something. But it's, you know, I guess this is better than what was going on at the time.
Why does it need a key at all? Who would dare drive this car except the Red Skull?
Yeah, doesn't it just need push to start or something? It just it's not the back in the 80s is when they finally came up with keyless entry fobs, like the Renault Fuego was the first one that had a keyless system that was kind of like, it was infrared, and it was kind of like the Zenith Space Command thing. You had to point the infrared light at the car, and it would unlock the doors from a distance, or as long as the distance was short and the infrared sensor was reading you correctly.
Now the Fuego, was that before or after Le Car?
I think Le Car was in the 70s.
Was that in the 70s? Was that far back? Wow.
Yeah. The one that looked like a sneaker.
Yes, exactly.
And from what I'm understanding, by 1983, American Motors, which had been, you know, kind of subsumed into Renault, the Renault Alliance had keyless entry available on it. But American car makers like General Motors didn't get into it until like 88, 89. And it's funny now that you have all these fobs and things. Now it feels kind of weird when you get in a car that actually requires a key. I had to rent a U-Haul truck the other day from Ford, and I didn't realize that Ford has the fob that you have the button on the side of it, and it comes out like the key comes out like a switchblade, and so you have to hit the button, pop out the key, and then stick it in the steering column. Just kind of a weird semi throwback.
Like, and you're sitting there like Scotty in Star Trek IV, you know, picking up the mouse of the Mac computer.
Hello, car. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, how quaint.
I'm still never sure about the, I know there's some cars that they have like the keypad on the outside of the car. Yes. And I've never driven one of those, but I'm never sure. Do you have to have the fob with you while you're typing in the numbers, or does that defeat the purpose of?
I have, and I don't think you do. I think the numbers get you into the car, but they don't start the car.
Ah,
you need something else to start the car.
Okay. My car has pin to drive. So even if you have the fob with you, you still have to type in, you know, it's like getting cash out of a cash machine. You have to type in the number. Otherwise, you can just sit there and listen to the radio while the police arrive.
And is it the same pin or is it a two-factor authentication thing where they have to
you have to wait for the text to show up on your phone or get an email.
Oh my gosh.
I'm getting one bar. I can't get in my car. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
The double-edged sword of technology.
I would love to talk about the Red Skull's car since we're getting there. And the first thing I want to say is he is bold as brass, man. He's got that Hydra emblem right up there on his hood ornament. He's about as subtle as Batman driving around a Batmobile with bat wings on it.
Yeah.
The car just screams evil. And I just imagine him like tooling down the Autobahn in this thing. With, you know, everybody else getting out of his way, like, oh, there goes the Red Skull. Okay, move aside.
And he has the conceit of the blackout lights, which were popular in World War II, so that the headlight beam would only show in front of you so that you wouldn't attract passing bombers. But
oh, that's an excellent observation. I didn't catch that at all. But yeah, there they are.
That nice chrome hexapus.
Yeah,
on the front. Hexapus. But yeah, it's like they'll never know it's me.
In case the moon glinting off your bright crimson head,
isn't
enough to get attention. At least the headlights aren't going to be giving you away.
Which one is it? The red guy, the big one.
Look for the red guy in the convertible, okay? And the convertible is as big as an aircraft carrier. You can't miss it.
Can't miss it, no.
And there's nothing like having a convertible in the Alps or where, I guess, yeah, he's in the Bavarian Alps, right?
That's right.
Up in the mountains, perfect place for roof-free driving.
It's another terrific job at looking at something that is, not quite real, but still, you know, just undeniably German. It looks to me like if you took a Mercedes 504K from the 30s and then, you know, gave it maybe a half a dose of super soldier serum and it got bigger and longer and more ostentatious and more bright working things. But very, very German design without it being just an off the shelf car. And of course, if he's flying his, I've already forgotten the word for tail sitter for the thrust wing, the Fliegeltrauber, of course he's going to drive a car that nobody else has.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like Doc Brown said to Marty McFly. It's like, if I'm going to make a time machine, what do you do with some style?
Exactly.
This car, actually, it's so over the top. It reminded me at first glance of, I don't know if anybody saw the terrible movie League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yes.
But there was definitely a car in there that had, six wheels and just looks like a Victorian nightmare. It's just, it's Rococo, it's Baroque, it's got like elephants on the fenders, and it's just this massive thing, the size of a house. I'm looking at it now, and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen's car was white, or kind of a creamy white, as opposed to the cool black of the Red Skull. But same design aesthetic. When you want to make a statement, you're going to drive one of these cars.
Yeah, and absolutely. Where would Red Skull drive himself? That's the I can't imagine him taking the wheel of a car that he would be sitting in the back formulating his plans. I don't know if he needed to get around by car, but he's the Red Skull. He can do what he wants.
I'd like to see his DMV picture.
Yeah. Skull, no skull.
Yeah. Does he have two sets of ID? One with the Hugo Weaving mask and one real.
Yes. Yeah, it's the middle initials RS. So Zola is, we're going to have to put a pin on Zola as he's disappearing. He has a valise in his car, in the car as he's heading off. So I'm not sure what he was carrying with him, but I'm assuming that do you think at this point he knows he has the possibility of getting captured?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were talking about that in the other episode, when he first started stuffing stuff into the valise, that there's, that valise is a bit of an insurance policy, and it's what he needs to keep, to stay valuable to the Red Skull. But it's also, I think, Jim, you were the one who said, if he gets up in his own operation paperclip, then he's got some currency that'll buy him some favor on the other side if need be.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that he went to the office and grabbed some blueprints, but I would have thought that he would have grabbed one of those little cigarette lighter things that Captain America took with him. Although maybe he has it in his pocket. He might have, secreted something later or earlier in his game.
Well, he probably knows that the skull grabbed the Tesseract, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
We
he
saw
was
the
I
skull
think he was
grab the
there when he
Tesseract.
grabbed it, yeah. So maybe just a little bit of the blue glue stuff.
Of course, we don't know what else is in the valise, but I'm with Hal. I'm sure whatever is in that valise would serve both the Red Skull and the Allies, depending on where he ended up.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to tune in on a later minute to see where he's going with all this stuff. But I think we've talked this particular minute into the ground or into the sky, and
into the sky and down the road.
Down the
road.
I want this car. I want this car. Not as much as I want the 1966 Batmobile, but this is a great car.
We'll bring plenty of turtle cool wax because you don't want to scratch.
Not a scratch.
Not a scratch.
Wow. Well,
and I just heard. Excuse me. When that not a scratch thing I meant to say earlier. All I can hear was Han Solo, Return of the Jedi. Handing off the keys to Lando. So I got your word, man. Not a scratch. Very different set of circumstances.
Wow.
And as we know, Lando does not. He brings it back with a scratch.
Not as good as his word. No.
Not as good as his word.
No. He had it. Well, how else was he going to get a toroidal antenna on the Millennium Falcon for later?
If he didn't just tear it off.
Well, he's a scoundrel.
Truly. Wow. Well, we can talk about this some more online if you'd like. Continue the conversation. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe, leave a link, or a like, rather. You can leave a link too, but I prefer if you left a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We've got some really good guests coming up shortly. Be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.